Today I had the privilege of speaking with Alan Hess, a fellow UCLA alumni. He's an architectural historian, preservationist, author, and lecturer. He's the author of nearly 20 books on mid-century modern architecture, many of them focusing on the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. He's been featured in countless architectural documentaries, and each year he's a contributing lecturer at the Palm Springs Mid-Century Modernism Week. He's also the commissioner on the California State Historical Resources Commission, and he serves on the board of the Orange County Preservation Society. So Alan and I had a great conversation focused on Los Angeles modernism. In a subsequent segment, we're going to dive into Palm Springs modernism, but let's get into the first piece and jump right into it. All right, Alan, well, thank you for coming in this morning. I just want to kind of get right into it and ask you about your career. How did you get into your work studying mid-century modern architecture and kind of, where you're at today?
Well, I've always been interested in history. I was a history major in college, and that's just carried over in my architecture career. I went to UCLA and got a master's there, had some great historians and architects teaching there who really introduced me to especially Southern California modern architecture. And so it's just been a continuing interest of mine. I see continuities. You don't have to reinvent everything every decade. In fact, I really believe that the most successful cities around the world, certainly here in California, are those who have recognized their architectural history and built on it over the years.
Sure.
Not just repeating, not just redoing what had come before, but realizing that their ideas, this architects, over 100 years ago, for example, here in California, in San Francisco and Los Angeles, realized that there was something special about this area, about the culture, about the climate, about the economy, and so forth. And that influenced their architecture, and later generations then built on that, improved, changed with changing times. So I, as an architect, I've just had a really strong feeling that the best architecture, the best city design, urban design, comes by recognizing what has gone before and then continuing those ideas into the future.
Well, great. That's a good segue kind of into the first topic I want to jump into. Can you kind of set the stage for us on Los Angeles modernism? What was happening in the world at the time? What was kind of the spirit of the time? Who were the main players that got this, this movement kind of kickstarted?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I need to hopefully end a myth, destroy a myth, which is very prevalent. It's prevalent, from the public in general, but even, trained architectural historians and architects as well have over the years developed this idea, very much mistaken, that European architects came to California and planted the seeds of modernism, which then grew into what we know today. The history simply does not support that. Once you get into the actual buildings, the actual people, what their motives were in designing buildings here. So I really want to kind of, your audience will just erase that myth and look at some of the facts about what was going on here in California. Again, now over 100 years, 120, 130 years even. Because California was on the edge of everything. It was just out in the middle of nowhere. On the edge of the world is what Richard Longstreth entitled one of his books about California architecture. And the thing was, because it was separated from Europe, from New York, from the East Coast, and which at that time had the largest population, and it was the economic focus of the United States and so forth, but California also had its own advantages, certainly natural wealth, beauty, great climate, connection to the Orient as well, to Asia, because of beyond the Pacific. And so an atmosphere developed here in California, again, going over 100 years ago, that had to do with, here we are in this, you know, Eden, Garden of Eden. Anything can grow here, you know. You can start your new life here. Forget about the past and whatever mistakes you made in the past. So there was this atmosphere that you could do anything. And then coming along with the 20th century, you have modern technology and all the advances of that, the steel and glass and concrete, plastics later, a little bit later on. And this sense of freedom, embracing new ideas, and that directly influenced the architects who were building here in California at that time. So this is the foundation for what we see today. In San Francisco, Los Angeles, Palm Springs, which we'll talk about. So that's kind of the, you know, the atmosphere that really encouraged both architects and their clients to try new ideas. So you have one of my favorites is Irving Gill.
Right. Yeah.
Irving Gill worked in the Chicago office of Adler and Sullivan, which was in the 1890s. Probably the most progressive advanced architecture firm in the country. I mean, inventing the skyscraper, the steel frame, all of these things that were so new at that time. Irving Gill was working with Adler and Sullivan at that time. Also working with Adler and Sullivan at the same time was Frank Lloyd Wright. And so those two careers are really interesting to follow and really, really important to understanding where we are today in terms of modern architecture.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Gill move to California due to almost a health condition, I believe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the, let's see, the late 1890s, he moved to San Diego and started his career there. Now, it took, eight years or so before he really hit his stride. But again, this is the influence of California. San Diego, probably the best weather in California. Smaller city at the time, but again, had a port, had an economy. But Gill took all of these elements and what he evolved, again, with his things he'd learned with Louis Sullivan to think in new ways, he developed, using concrete, a new type of architecture, which was modern, had nothing, well, very little to do with historical architecture. It expressed concrete. He was one of the first to really develop tilt-up concrete structures, which was a new fabrication method made possible by the developing concrete industry at that time. But then he also mated it with the culture of California and San Diego in particular, the Hispanic, the Mission culture, which had come, you know, much earlier, but also reflected the place at the time, the climate. So those missions would have long arcades to shelter from the sun, you know, and they were adobe, they were masonry. Much like concrete, and that was perfect for the hot and the cold of this area, a perfect material for it. So Gill took all of these elements of what was going on in California and basically invented a new architecture, a new style, a new way of expressing all of this for the modern period. Indoor-outdoor living, for example. Many of his houses, you know, the living rooms had sliding glass doors, wood framed at the time, but they would slide completely off of the wall of the house, so that the living room was at one with the terrace, the patio. Mm-hmm. And he would have trellises, and he would have vines growing up on them to take advantage of, you know, the beautiful growing season here for plants and everything. So Gill really understood the modern materials and the way people wanted to live in this new spirit of California. And he developed an architecture for that. So Gill is incredibly important. When was it? Last year? 2019 or 2020 was his 100th birthday, 150th birthday.
Wow.
Did you hear anything
about
it? Nothing. Yeah, I mean, and I've talked to people, you know, educated about architecture from New York. We've never heard of Irving Gill.
Right.
And yet he is this incredibly important, inventive architect. So this is what I'm saying when I say, you know, this myth that modernism was imported into California. No. With people like Gill and Frank Lloyd Wright and Lloyd Wright, Frank Lloyd Wright's son. They all were responding to these conditions. They were creative architects. They were looking for new ideas, new inspiration, new resources to do something new with, to challenge them.
Right, right.
And so this is what was going on in California. California was an incubator for modern, appropriate, progressive architectural ideas. And that is one of the traditions that I think we can follow today in architecture.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of there's that preconception that the Europeans like Neutra, Schindler, Frey, you know, those people brought the international style over and kind of embedded it into the culture. And yeah, Gill and Frank Lloyd Wright with his textile block houses, all of that seems to come out of Chicago, right? Out of the Midwest, especially still. I mean, people like Lautner also came from the Midwest too.
Yeah.
You know, that's another example of it. Lautner working in Taliesin, coming out to Los Angeles, actually not liking it in Los Angeles, but then, you know, starting his career here. So it's interesting, that perspective.
Yeah, Lautner had a love-hate relationship with Los Angeles. He actually could not have been John Lautner anywhere else.
Right, yeah.
So there was a lot about Los Angeles that, you know, inspired him and made him what he was. But yes, coming from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan on the shores of Lake Superior, gorgeous landscape, forests, you know, rock outcroppings, and the desert climate of Los Angeles was very different, but he used it.
Right, yeah, he made the best of it.
One thing also about Neutra and Schindler and Frey, and there were many others from Europe, immigrants from Europe. It's always interesting that, you know, in the 20s and especially in the 30s when the Nazis came into Germany and so many artistic people as well as others left,
right,
including a number of architects. Some of them ended up in the New York area, one or two in Chicago, one or two in San Francisco, but most of them came to Los Angeles.
Sure.
Which again at the time was on the edge of nowhere. I mean, you know, it was, you know, Hollywood and, you know, a couple of oil fields. You know, it wasn't that big a city, certainly nothing like Manhattan. And yet all of these really creative architects came. And again, this myth that modernism was imported, planted in Los Angeles, in California, just accepted. But if you look at the work of Neutra and Schindler and Frey in particular, after they moved here to California, it changed.
Right.
They learned from what they were seeing in California.
And the climate, too.
And the climate. Yeah. And they were excited about it. And so I often say that California was a muse to these architects and really shaped what they did. They would not have done what they had, what they did, if they had ended up in some other place.
Right. I think it's interesting the kind of story you told about Frey, where he was working with Corbusier in Europe, and I think Corbusier used to say, you know, used to call him the American, right? And I think that just kind of shows how a lot of Europeans were viewing America at the time, the land of opportunity. They wanted to come there. They were excited about what was happening. And I think that pulled many of these, you know, people out of Europe.
Yes. Of course, America had escaped the ravages of World War I, which really set Europe back. There wasn't that much building going on in Europe. of a creative nature, but America was plowing ahead, was being prosperous, and America had Henry Ford as well. After World War I, the American public was being put on wheels. The best introduction to the modern era you could possibly imagine. It wasn't for the upper classes, but it was where every American, basically, could afford a Model T, and it would transform their lives in so many different ways, and transform their cities, and transform their architecture. And this is the sort of thing that was going on in America that attracted these really creative, young, modern architects like Neutra and Albert Frey and Rudolf Schindler and others as well to come to America, to this new way of life, the industry and the use of new materials, prefabricated steel houses and on. The potential for a creative architect was incredible. And things were actually being built here. So that's what really drew a lot of these ambitious young architects to come to America, and particularly to California at that time.
Perfect. Well, I kind of want to change course and talk about Wright, or jump back to speaking about Wright. Can you talk a little bit about his textile blockhouses and how he started kind of embedding himself into California and how he developed his career out here?
Yeah, Wright is such a fascinating character and a great architect as well, who understood all of these things, the new trends in technology and the new trends in culture, and the ongoing trends of American life and culture, especially the integration of nature with human life, which goes back to Walt Whitman and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thomas Jefferson. So that's deeply embedded in American life. So Wright, brilliant young architect in Chicago. He helps to invent the prairie style. This is around around 1900 through 1920 or so. But then he gets this great commission to build the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo.
Right.
So he spends most of the teens going back and forth between Tokyo and his home in Chicago, or outside Chicago. But during that time, he really kind of loses touch with American architecture, which is going in a different direction, actually, by that time. So by the time the hotel opens, Wright is almost, has been, forgotten.
Right.
Still extremely talented, still very ambitious, obviously. But what's he do? And he then thinks about moving to Los Angeles, a new city, progressive, they're building things, etc. And so he does, for a time, settle in Los Angeles, works with his son, Lloyd Wright, who is already here, had worked for Irving Gill initially in 1912 in San Diego. But Wright is interested in bringing his ideas from Chicago, from Louis Sullivan, to California, except adapting them, changing them. Uh-huh. Now, I hope your audience has an idea of what a prairie-style house is.
Right, yeah.
It is designed for Chicago and Chicago weather.
Right.
Wide eaves so that you cut out the sun in the blistering, hot, humid summers, but which lets the sun in during the very cold, windy winters as well. So he invents a modern architecture that is responding to climate of a particular area. Comes out to Los Angeles, very different climate, Mediterranean climate, desert climate as well. And he becomes interested in this new material of concrete. What are its possibilities? As we talked about, Irving Gill was developing certain directions down in San Diego and Los Angeles at the time. Wright becomes interested in this concrete block system. He called it the textile block system because you have square concrete blocks, but then they were kind of woven together with steel rebars. So it was like a fabric, hence the name textile block. Now, he works on the development of this with his son, Lloyd Wright, as well. Lloyd needs to get some credit for that, too. But Wright designs a series of these concrete block houses in Los Angeles, late teens, early 20s, including the Freeman House in Hollywood, the Millard House in Pasadena, the Ennis House in Hollywood as well, and developing this really startling new idea. Now, the concept was the same. The fundamental organic idea Wright had was architecture should respond to climate, place, topography, mm-hmm. plant life, etc. Except when you're in a different climate, it should look different. And so that's why there's this difference between his earlier prairie houses and then these concrete block houses. Good. In Los Angeles. So it just goes back to this idea, what makes good architecture? It is knowing, understanding, and then being creative about the local conditions, including the client and what they want and what their lifestyle is.
Right. And wasn't there some kind of speculation that he took a trip to South America and was exposed to Mayan architecture prior to working in the textile block houses?
Well, that is, again, a good trend, a good idea, which actually distinguishes American modern architecture often from European modern architecture. In Europe, modern architects were mostly actually, you know, socialists. In Europe, of course, you had monarchies and a whole political system, which modernists of all sorts, including modern architects wanted to overthrow.
Sure.
The kings and the monarchs were the old system. It was oppressive. It led to wars.
Also kind of, I think, based on a lot of representation as opposed to kind of a pared back architecture focused on truth and also authenticity. I know that Neutra, in one of his, I think it was his autobiography, he talked about how in Vienna when he was growing up, he saw the government in Vienna and how the architecture and how these kind of rituals and traditions at the government there were just so fake, for a lack of a better term. And that's why I think he sought truth, and probably one of the fundamental reasons why he expressed that through his architecture.
Yeah. So that was part of the spirit of European modern architecture, was to overthrow that oppressive past. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to have anything to do with history. In America, it was different. And Wright was looking for models here in the New World, which could be incorporated into a new, fresh, appropriate architecture. And one of that was the architecture of the Yucatan, of Mayan and Aztec architecture, which, of course, was hundreds of years before that time. But which also grew out of this unique environment of North and South America. So yes, his concrete block houses do draw on the architecture of the Maya, which are wonderful buildings, very impressive. They're civic architecture. I mean, they're monumental.
Right.
The pyramids and so forth. But they have this wonderful texture on them. That was cut stone, but Wright then translates that into the new material of concrete. So his concrete block houses have these wonderful intricate patterns on the concrete blocks, which create, capture the sunlight, create shadow and sun, and again, bring alive the building for this particular area. So, Wright was not averse to learning from, borrowing from history. And as I mentioned with Gill, the same way. Gill learned from the missions of the Franciscan friars as well, and didn't copy them, but used them as an inspiration appropriate for his 20th century architecture.
That's an interesting relationship, Gill with the early Spanish settlers and the mission architecture, and then Frank Lloyd Wright, his relationship with the South American architecture. I mean, and how those kind of, both of those pieces of architecture or their, let's call it, their buildings are hybrids of kind of a modern aesthetic and then something from the past.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Certainly in California, far divorced from New York and the centers of, you know, architecture and cultural power, there was not the same kind of forbidden, you had to ignore history.
Right.
Yeah. Here you could incorporate it into your architecture without being afraid of being censured for that.
Sure, sure. So can we transition into one of Wright's proteges, John Lautner, and kind of talk about his career trajectory and how he spent his time at Taliesin, and then kind of how he embedded himself in the Los Angeles architectural scene?
Yeah, John Lautner. I've written a book about John Lautner. I knew him as well, had a chance to get to know him and to interview him. And then finally write a book about him. And I really do think that my being a native of Southern California, I had an insight into what his work was all about. There were others, much more famous architectural historians who had wanted to write about him, but Lautner knew that they did not really get him.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't want to be appropriated by them for their purposes. But he was, he was quite friendly with me, I think, because I understood that, what was special about his work here. So anyway, he was born in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, beautiful setting, out in forests. He got this integral understanding of nature, of rocks and of forests. And for example, the quality of light in a forest where the sunlight dapples down onto the ground and so forth. So in the early 1930s, Frank Lloyd Wright writes his autobiography and that he is starting a school of architecture, Taliesin, he calls it, after his home in Wisconsin. And Lautner is intrigued by this. He's in college at that point, but he decides to go into architecture and to join this fellowship of Taliesin. And he is part of the second class that comes through. A number of really great architects were attracted to Wright at that time. Alden Dow, Edgar Taffel, Bob Mosier, several others who went on to be very prominent. But Lautner was one of them. So Lautner spends about 5 or 6 years at Taliesin. Now, the course of study there was basically just to do stuff.
Right.
It wasn't
housework
courses.
Included, too, right?
Housework, yes. Yeah. Cooking, plumbing. Lautner became very good at plumbing, actually. And when Wright needed a new road, they would get the graders out and they would build a road. We needed a wall, a new wing, whatever. They would learn by doing.
Uh-huh.
But then Frank Lloyd Wright was right there beside them.
Benefiting from it.
Benefiting yeah. from it, definitely. But giving this, what Lautner had said about that time at Taliesin is that he didn't do much. He didn't design that much. But he said he was absorbing this atmosphere and what Wright was saying, and then doing this stuff with Wright, literally. And at a certain point, about 1937, I think it is, 38, he decides to go on his own. He has, he is married, he has a family along the way, and so he feels it's time to leave Taliesin and to make it on his own. So he tries to decide where to move to. He thinks about Boston, which is a fascinating thing. What would Lautner have done in Boston?
Right.
But he ends up in Los Angeles, which is the perfect place for him because of the creative thinking of clients and the building going on and so forth. He also has gets a job early on supervising one of Frank Lloyd Wright's houses, the Sturgis House in Brentwood, which is being built at that time. So he continues his association with Wright. He supervises on a number of other projects that Wright had going here. So he had a little bit of income coming in, but then he also gets a couple of commissions from people who had gone to Frank Lloyd Wright, discovered that the design would be too difficult or too expensive to build.
Sure.
And so Wright says, well, I have this fellow, the student, John Lautner. You might try him. And Lautner, being a young, hungry architect, designs some houses for former Wright clients. But the thing is, when Lautner moves to Los Angeles, you know, after all these years of absorbing, suddenly it starts bursting out.
Yeah.
Because he does get these commissions. And he's just, it's fascinating. The earliest work is reflective of Frank Lloyd Wright's work. But very soon on, Lautner takes these organic architectural ideas of Wright in new directions. He really takes to heart the idea that you don't repeat yourself. You don't repeat somebody else. You don't copy somebody else. You start with these ideas and you develop them. And that's why Lautner is so famous, so well respected today, because virtually each of his houses is an interesting, unique idea, which he then works out to just a remarkable degree. Now, he's known today as an architect of big, beautiful, very expensive, luxurious houses, which he did later on in his career, finally. But the fact is, in the early years, from the 1950s into the 1960s, he is doing small houses for middle-class families, custom houses. But, you know, they're, you know, 1,500 square feet or, you know, 2,000 square feet. They are normal average houses on normal size lots. But each of them is just this incredible idea that Lautner is working out. One of my favorites is the Carling House from 1949. Uh-huh. Interesting house. Finished the same year as Charles Eames's house out in Pacific Palisades. Which, of course, is very famous. Both are steel structures. The Eames house takes standardized metal beams and columns and trusses and puts them together into that beautiful house. Lautner's idea is, how do you build on a steep site?
Uh-huh.
And so he creates a system with steel masts. And he put three of them on the Carling House site and then suspends the roof from those masts.
Interesting.
But the mast, again, it's a steep site, so the mast can be, you know, have different sorts of foundations, but still create then a level interior for the house. I mean, it's a brilliant solution. And so that's Lautner's career early on. In 1960, he meets up with a fascinating Southern California character and client, Ken Reiner, who I also got to know. Fascinating man. He made a huge amount of money in aerospace. He developed a clip which would clip together the metal panels of an airplane and made a lot of money from that invention. But he always had new ideas going along. So he meets up with Lautner. Lautner and Reiner are just two peas in a pod. A lot of energy, looking for new ideas, being inventive. And Reiner had money. And so Lautner is designing his house, which becomes known as Silver Top in Silver Lake.
Yeah.
One of Lautner's masterpieces.
This is the one with kind of a cantilevering driveway?
Yeah. you know, interesting story on that cantilevered driveway up, you know, a steep site. There's nothing in the Los Angeles building codes that would permit that.
Sure, yeah.
Nobody had imagined it before.
Yeah.
And so, but Lautner designs it. Lautner had some really good structural engineers working with him all the way along as well. Engineers who were excited about doing something new and original and innovative. This is a Southern California pattern
sure.
that we are seeing. But Reiner had the money not only for the house, but for a lawsuit. And so he told the planning department that, you know, I'm going to build this. I don't care. So he did a test where they built this driveway and then they loaded it with sandbags to the weight that it would be required and then beyond. And it didn't fall down. It's still there today. And so Lautner could not have had a better, more supportive client than Reiner.
I feel like that was didn't Frank Lloyd Wright do the same thing on his Johnson Wax where he loaded those columns
exactly.
with sand and they actually never, or it took, what, three times the amount that it was meant to bear
yeah.
to take
yeah.
it down?
Because that was such an unusual, those kind of dendril-shaped columns. And as a matter of fact, Lautner was at Taliesin and was there in Madison, Wisconsin on the day that, or no, Racine, Wisconsin, on the day that they did that. So yeah, he learned from the master there.
So in relationship, Silvertop to the Chemosphere, was Chemosphere after Silvertop or was that before?
Chemosphere was started at about the same time,
okay.
and but was finished much sooner. Yeah, another fascinating idea, how to build on a steep site. So he constructed a single column, mm-hmm. Which could had a foundation to it, and then this circular house balanced on top of that column. Of course, it's one of the most famous houses in Los Angeles now, above Mulholland Drive. But it's interesting, and interesting in the way that Lautner has been seen in popular culture, because that house, when published, it looks like a flying saucer.
Sure.
Which, of course, during the space age was a really interesting theme. It's not what it inspired Lautner to do it. But it has shown up in a number of movies as the home of either a villain or of some wacko degenerate or a murderer or whatever. And there's this idea that there's this popular, another myth, that popular architecture of that sort, far out architecture, was only for, you know, the fringe, for
sure.
people who maybe were a little, you know, questionable in some way. Right. In fact, the Chemosphere House was built for an aerospace engineer, Leonard Malin, mm-hmm. was very actively involved in building the house. And he had a family, he had, I can't remember, three or four children. It was a family home. It wasn't for, you know, a James Bond villain.
Right.
It was for an average Southern California family in the mid-century. But they were open to that sort of idea.
Now, wasn't his other house in Palm Springs, it was shown in a movie, one of James Bond movie. I'm blanking on the name right now.
Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Are Forever, yeah. I mean, that's the same kind of theme carried out.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Well, good. So as far as Lautner's biggest impact or his legacy on Los Angeles, what do you feel that is? Is it a, you know, spirit of experimentation? Is it a, what do you feel like his legacy is on Los Angeles?
Well, again, one of the important things about Southern California architecture in general is that it is a variety of different ways of looking at architecture. Today we've unfortunately, in some ways, kind of narrowed down the idea of what mid-century modern architecture was about to boxy architecture, flat roofs. In fact, what Lautner proves, and there are many other examples, is that it was a spirit of creativity, mm-hmm. of flowering of new ideas. Because Lautner was not into building boxes.
Right.
He created these organic forms, these flowing forms. He got into concrete architecture in particular, because that allowed him to create these flowing forms. But it wasn't just to create a fantastic shape. Mm-hmm. Lautner was always creating space.
Right.
He was, and again, this is something he got from Wright. You design the space for whatever the purpose is. Living spaces, sleeping spaces, dining spaces, view spaces to take in the views of some of these great sites that he was able to build on. So when we think of Southern California architecture, we shouldn't just think about one style. Mm-hmm. We have to think about all of these styles. That Lautner certainly is one of the great exemplars of that.
Yeah, I know in your paper on LA Modernism, you kind of went through modernism from its conception all the way to, you know, brutalism and then postmodernism. And it was amazing to see the different buildings that were built and occurred during that time period. And yeah, it's not just one type of building or one aesthetic. There's a large array of buildings that were completed during that time.
And if I might add to that, that is part of the value of this modern history today.
Uh-huh.
Because architects today have so much to build on, mm-hmm. so many different directions, creative directions in their architecture because of this history of Wright and Lautner and Schindler and Neutra and many, many others.
I feel like one of the reoccurring themes between a lot of the modernists too with, Lautner, absolutely, Neutra, Wright, and Frey, well, definitely Neutra though, and I had this discussion about a month ago, but how they design from the inside out, right? So they're thinking about the human experience and how a person, walks through the house, and they're almost thinking of this, they're almost designing as a cinematographer of a movie, you know, based upon experience. I feel like in the industry now, sometimes that's not really the basis for design, unfortunately. Sometimes I think we can get caught thinking of a building from the exterior as a formal exercise, but not really thinking about how the human experience is going to be. So if we're going to extract a nugget of wisdom from them, I would say that would definitely be one of the ones that's top of my list.
Yeah, I would agree. And Lautner is a great example of that. And it concerns me a bit because his buildings are so photogenic, mm-hmm. and they get in the magazines and people say, you know, I want something, you know, noticeable like Silvertop or the Arango house down in Mexico that Lautner designed, as well. But what makes those houses wonderful is that Lautner designed that interior space first. He frankly didn't care what it looked like on the outside that much.
Sure.
But he cared very much and put a lot of attention into those living spaces. And again, I've over the years knew a number of Lautner clients who stayed in the houses for decades, and they just loved it. It supported their way of life so wonderfully because he did put that much attention into the spaces.
It's interesting how many architects now, I feel like, almost forfeit the opportunity to design and articulate the interior of a home or a building. I think in general, we need to kind of recapture that that scope and be more thoughtful about how the interiors on our homes and buildings work.
Yeah, I'll never forget my experience at Lautner's Mauer House a number of years ago. I was writing about it for Fine Home Building magazine. Got a chance to spend a whole day there, just experiencing this space and realizing how Lautner had considered every single detail. Started off, it was kind of a foggy morning, but then the sun came through and warmed up the space. It moved through the house through the day until the evening when it, of course, the sun went down. But then the lights of the city in the distance came on, and you could see this was all part of this experience of the house. Fireplace over in an ingle nook as well, creating a focal point. All of these details to make a beautiful living space at one with nature, mm-hmm. which of course was always important to Lautner. design makes all the difference.
Right. Well, good. I feel like that's a good place to kind of wrap this one up, Alan, and then we can transition into the next segment on desert modernism. But is there any, can you give the listeners a way to contact you? Can you put your website out there and just let them know how to reach you?
Yeah, my website is alanhess.org, and I've written 20 books. You can Google those as well. They're available on Amazon and other places as well. So, I'm giving talks involved with Modernism Week in Palm Springs. I've been involved with the Los Angeles Conservancy. I've written for their website on Southern California architectural history. So, number of places.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Alan. I appreciate it. And we'll move into the next segment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for watching the episode. If you'd like to learn more, you can go ahead and visit us at www.rostarchitects.com. If you'd like to see other episodes of the podcast, go ahead and click right here to learn more. Thanks, guys.